from Isaiah 1. What are your endless sacrifices to me, says Yahweh? I am sick of holocausts and rams and the fat of calves. The blood of bulls and the goats revolts me. When you come to present yourselves before me, who asks you to trample all over my courts? Bring me your worthless offerings no more. The smoke of them fills me with disgust. Then listen to all these rituals that they go through. New moon, Sabbath, assemblies. I cannot endure festival and solemnity. Your new moons and your pilgrimage I hate with all my soul. They lie heavy on me. I am tired of bearing them. When you stretch out your hands, you know, that's a Jewish way of prayer. When you stretch out your hands, then the picture is, I turn my eyes away. God, just looking the other direction, I just can't stand this. You may multiply your prayers, I shall not listen. Your hands are covered with blood. Wash, make yourselves clean. And then take your wrongdoing out of my sight. Cease to do evil, learn to do good. Search for justice. Help the oppressed. Be just to the orphan and plead for the widow. And then the idea is, then the ritual will make sense. When there's a harmony of life and ritual and life and ritual. Remember how we talked last time, how then ritual is, our last session at 9 o'clock, we did drama. You know, and a ritual is a drama that a community develops over the years to picture in dance and speech and talk and art and music and movement and body movement, and you can go on and on, sight and smell, everything to dramatize its life and the deep values of its life. And then a community moves from life to ritual, and what the ritual does is it takes the community and the ritual itself reincorporates the people into the way of life. So the people really set up the ritual, but then the ritual that the people set up actually then does something to the people to reincorporate them into the life. So now where we'll begin again today is to ask the question of the lifestyle, or we use the word spirituality. The spirituality, is there a spirituality that runs through the scripture which is finally ritualized in our worship? And where we left off last time, I'm going to go back now to the Egypt model. This is where, in a way, the story begins. And the Egypt model had the Egyptian divinity up here, then the Pharaoh, the court. And we had just kind of miscellaneous big deals. And then the people of Egypt. And then the slaves. And this is now the setting of the biblical story. And this setting now will run, I think, through the entire scriptures. We'll call this in our sessions the Egypt way. And then I just added kind of a priesthood here that's blessing the system. These are priests. And they're, in this system, priests are very necessary because it is very important that everyone be convinced that this is a divine order meant for all times, invented by God and sustained by God and perpetuated by God or the gods. That's why I think a priesthood is more necessary for this system than an army. Because if people are spiritually conditioned that this is the way it always is and the way it always shall be, then the system remains under perfect control. And we began last time to say that we have to begin to see the God of the Bible is not the God here, but the God that is sneaking in down here in all kinds of acts of humor. Now, I'd like just to get our mindset to the world to which the Bible speaks. I'd like to begin today by just dividing up into buzz groups of three, just like three, 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 three. Susan and I will talk. And in your buzz group, just think of some way in the world today and stretch all the way from the great systems of the world down to personal relationships in your life. I mean, think of the whole gamut, not just politics or not just, but think of ways in the whole gamut where this system, which we call the Egyptian system, works, and how we are involved, or just without a lot of discussion of analyzing, just say different ways where there are systems like this in the world today. Maybe in your group of three, come up with two examples. Both, well, I don't have to repeat it. Do you get it, the question? Okay. Let's take, this shouldn't take long. Let's take like 4 minutes.
There's a poem that goes to this. I don't know the poem, but it's set up that the AMA, the American Medical Association, is at the top, and then come the hospital administrators, then come the doctors, then come the nurses, and then the patients are at the very bottom of the list.
How about the nurses' aides and the orderlies?
Well, those would all go into nurses in terms of caring for, doing the level of patient care.
I've found in a hospital, is this true, that because the system is that way, then in each branch, that branch develops, like a RN, well, and an LPN.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, each one. Yeah, even in terms of nursing, it's that way. I think nursing is really struggling to be a profession, and so the model is to set up a hierarchy like that. I guess in that way, yeah, it would be the AMA would be the priest, because they feed everything into, maybe even the government would be the top, and then the AMA would be the people who feed into them. Because
this is the way it has to be. But I do think.
Or insurance companies, excuse me. Insurance companies. Maybe, but I guess I feel like they are just, they don't really have that much power in the system.
The priesthood would be kind of the idea that's floating around, that this is the only way it can be.
Yeah. Okay.
This question, June, is going to be our struggle with the whole Bible. You know, and what part of our sessions is going to be look at this struggle. And we'll look at that early Israel under the judges was pretty much an egalitarian society without a leader. They only had a leader for temporary purposes at times of crisis, and that person would fade back into the equality. And finally they did say what you said, this isn't realistic. You know, so we're, and then what did Jesus say in the upper room to his disciples when he says the Gentiles lord it over each other and they have big bosses and little people? He says that it shall not be so among you. Wow. So let's hold that struggle, shall we? Does a marriage ever happen? This pen is gone. I just got it moved. Does a marriage ever happen like this? Or just a relationship? Have you ever seen that? But have you ever heard somebody speak that this is divinely ordered?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That you have God, man, woman, and then children. And that's the divine order. Do you agree with that? The New Testament says so in one place. What? Ephesians.
Well, we were talking about that the other night at the forum, how sometimes the woman would be in the place of the man. Mm-hmm. There are times when we are weaker and we are stronger. It's just human.
Mm-hmm.
We're human. I mean, that is a shared kind of a leaning.
Mm-hmm. I think what we see now, that just this discussion is this is the world we live in. And totally immersed in this kind of a world. You know, and finally, and then we struggle with, is this reality? Is this the way it has to be? And let's keep that now and realize that in all of these different areas, and this is what during our sessions I'm going to call the Egypt way, just as a way to symbolize it. And when I write that, I always like to put Egypt in quotes so it doesn't seem like a knock at the current nation of Egypt, which should not be set apart as being better or worse than any other country on this earth. Right? Right.
The pyramid is kind of strictly a symbol of meaning we should emphasize domination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's the Egyptian model is each level lords it over the level below.
It's very stable.
Yeah. And then economically, the wealth is here. It also is a triangle because this group is always smaller. And the group at the bottom is almost always the largest. That would be the most common, the largest. And this both has the economic wealth and the economic power.
So, I mean, we have structures that are pyramid structures, and the pyramid structure itself perhaps isn't bad, but it's the fact of how it works in terms of dominating mm-hmm. and being oppressive to other people that, in that fashion, it's not something.
Well, let's think about
that.
Is it just that we want the system to work well, or now Egypt had this eternally set? So where you were was your life, and so did feudalism. The interesting thing that the democratic revolutions and the American Constitution brought was these wonderful ladders. Or you could climb up, right? Even be president. But the pyramid is still intact, but you have the freedom to, you can even go down a level if you want to, or up a level. Yeah.
Is this a reflection of our society now, this hierarchy?
Do you think it is?
I'd be willing to speculate that children are closer to God than men and women. Mm-hmm. Not in power and wealth, mm-hmm. but in God-likeness.
Right. You're probably reflecting Jesus by saying that. No. Then you'd have to ask the question, well, does our society honor children? Or does our church honor children? To reflect that. So keep in mind now as we move the statement that Jesus did say to his disciples, this is not the way it shall be among you. You, plural, your community, your people. This is not the way it shall be among you. Jesus called this the way of the Gentiles. Which very specifically in Jesus' time, this is the way of the Roman Empire. Let's go back to Egypt and see what God does. It's a wonderful story. And so I hope you have a chance to at least read the part of it that I assigned. Or I sat down this morning and read the whole story of all the frogs, locusts, plagues, blood. All the gnats, all the scratchy boils and all kinds of new things. I had forgotten that Moses never said, we want to leave Egypt. He said, we just want to go out in the desert and have a little worship service. Did you notice that when you read it?
Yeah.
Pharaoh knew that they would never come back.
And they're part about borrowing the gold and jewelry from Egypt. Why
did
the Egyptians do that?
What? Well, they were probably scratching their... They weren't doing too well with these people around.
And why would that someone to do that?
I don't know. There's a lot of unanswered questions when you read this story. You know that, and one of the most when I went to a Jewish Passover, one of the most beautiful parts of it was a time when the Jewish people actually take time in the Passover meal to express sorrow for the suffering of the Egyptians. You know, and it's the unanswered question, why did these people have to suffer so much for our liberation? You know, that was, it's part of the Passover, and I think it's a very, it's a beautiful part, I think, of it. But I'm just going to briefly look at the story and just some of the key parts. Let's go to Exodus. Now, notice, I'll just read some of these parts quickly. Exodus 2, 23 to 25. During this long period, the king of Egypt died, and the children of Israel, groaning in their slavery, cried out for help, and from the depths of their slavery, their cry came up to God. And God heard their groaning, and he called to mind his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God looked down upon the children of Israel. Here you have a weeping God when God looks at the triangle and sees at the bottom of the triangle the slaves who are oppressed. And notice the flickering of spiritual hope now, for the very crying out to God is a radical departure from the message of the priests, that maybe God of our ancestors will say things can be different. Things don't have to be this way. So they cry out and they groan to God. And one of the themes to look in both the Exodus and also the wilderness wandering is how they slip back into the slave mind all the time. You know, maybe the Egyptian way is the right way. At least we had watermelons. And different things they say like that. Just different things to point out. When Moses then goes to ask that the people go out to this worship, then the response of the Pharaoh is to lay the burden of brick-making even heavier on these slaves. And notice in 5:8, he says, they are lazy, and that is why their cry is, let us go and offer sacrifice to our God. And I'll ask this question. Have oppressed, exploited people in our age ever been called lazy? No. Okay. Think how often we hear that as the reason to really not care about mothers on welfare, the poor in our country. The easiest way to cross them all off, and it was being done back in Egypt. They're lazy. And again, it's in verse 17. You are lazy when you say you want to go and offer sacrifice to your God. Then if you want to make a mark and really get in the habit, if you don't mind this, the Bible can be marked. Did you ever have that holy feeling about the Bible that you shouldn't mark it? One of the most beautiful gospel passages in the Bible is Exodus 6, 2 through 13. Starting with 6, I am Yahweh, I will free you of the burdens which the Egyptians lay on you. I will release you from slavery to them, and with my arm outstretched and my strokes of power, I will deliver you. And then this beautiful gospel phrase, I will adopt you as my own people. I'll go to the adoption agency, and you'll become my child and my children, and I will be your God. Then you shall know that it was I, Yahweh, your God, who freed you from the Egyptians. Then I will bring you to the land I swore that I would give to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and will give it to you for your own. I, Yahweh, will do this. And Moses told this to the children of Israel. Now look at the slave mentality here. But they would not listen to him, so crushed was their spirit, and so cruel their slavery. good news wasn't even anything to be heard because they were so crushed. They couldn't believe it, that this could ever happen. That's one of the delightful, humorous things, is you don't have a bunch of slaves here all excited about being free. You have a God that's doing all of the work, and he has two jobs. God, I should say, God has two jobs. One is to convince the slaves that they can actually get up and walk out of Egypt, and the other is to have Pharaoh let them go. And I would ask, which is harder?
Convince the slaves.
Maybe that's, maybe that's just as hard. We've had people here from South Africa, and they say the spiritual crushing of South African blacks, how they're taught from childhood to really believe they are so inferior that they can do nothing. That it's not, that the equal battle to changing the government in South Africa is changing the minds.
I should say the same thing is true if you work with battered women.
Or just a marriage of domination. By the male, the women I've talked to just say things cannot be different. It's just as the way it has to be. Well, that's a slave mind. Well, let's just tell the story, and it's a story again. If you have the triangle, I always like to have the little door, and it's this God that sneaks in and is with the slaves. Now, who are these slaves that now, finally, after all the plagues, and if you ever go to Egypt, you know, on a tour, and Karen and I got to quite a few years ago, one of the most amazing sights in the National Museum in Cairo is you can actually be this far, with the glass, of course, between you, but you can be this far from the actual face of the Pharaoh that Moses spoke to. And it's Ramses II. Most scholars would say it was Ramses II. And they actually had the mummified face of Ramses II in the museum. And you can stand there, and you're this far from his face, and you realize you're exactly looking into the face that Moses looked into and says, we want to go out in the desert and have a worship service. It is incredible to think that you're, well, but you're closer than Moses. And then the other thing is how here was the mightiest person on earth at one time, and now he's this shriveled up piece in a museum, you know. Just, and you get a sense of how God, like in Mary's song, you know, the mighty are brought low. What is this Pharaoh today? Somebody we gawk at in the museum. And so, who are these slaves? One, there are two kinds of people. And I remember my Old Testament professor saying that, and then I actually read it today. In chapter 12, verse 38, first of all, it was a people that shared a memory of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In other words, they were descendants of these ancestral patriarchal people. So they had the memory of a God who touched their ancestors, Abraham and Sarah. They were bound. But then when they were ready to leave Egypt, notice that slaves of all sorts, it was just come and join us. So it was not just what we would call Israelites that went out, but all this motley group of slaves from Egypt, they all got out of there. This was one of the great revolutions of history. Of the whole slave people of a static society just getting up and leaving. Wow. So it's the people of memory, and then others, slaves, who joined them.
Where do you find that?
Chapter 12, 37 and 38, the children of Israel left Ramses for Succoth, about 600,000 on the march. Now that's a very exaggerated figure. All men, not counting their families. Okay, they had certain hierarchical and things when they wrote the book. People of various sorts joined them in great numbers, and there were flocks too, and herds, and in immense droves, and they baked cakes with dough, and they've all brought their lunches now. Okay, and they're on their way out of Egypt.
But that means there was other people that were not affected by the plagues and so on, as well as the Israelites.
Yeah, the story doesn't tell what, you know, maybe they were. Maybe they were.
In the past, when you mentioned in terms of the Jewish praying for the Egyptians, in terms of the pyramid, to wipe out that whole bottom age, in terms of their society, how it kept continuing to function, someone had to step to get back. I don't know. But there's still other slaves that didn't go, or I imagine they kept their system.
Oh, yeah. I would guess that the majority.
If they were just in a certain region up there in the north.
Yeah. And I would guess the majority of slaves would say, let's just stay where it's safe, you know, let's not just get involved with this. That's just some guessing that we do. Now, an amazing, your map, I'll just set this out here on page 23. If you haven't heard this, that the Red Sea as to where they crossed is a mistranslation. Red Sea, it is Sea of Reeds. Reed. Sea of Reeds. And probably in this northern part, the Red Sea, see, today is down here. Now, an amazing thing happens that they go and they're at the water's edge. And then the Egyptian armies follow them, and then they say, oh no, here they are, it's all over. It's all over. This was too good to be true. Now they're going to take us back, and it will be worse. And then comes what we call the primal narrative. And if you want to use that word, or there's all kinds of words you can say, primal story. The primal story, meaning the story that gives the entire Hebrew Bible its basis, and the people of that Bible. They are the people of this story, and that is the story of the Exodus. And in the text, you'll notice that there are really two stories that are fit into one. One is a more, a more realistic story of a wind blowing and drying up this muddy area, and they walk across, and then the chariots get stuck in the mud. And the other is the Cecil B. DeMille story. They're kind of, you can tell in the text there that the two stories are intertwined. But whatever happened, they got across, and the Egyptians were stuck. And then you have this marvelous, marvelous worship. Then on the other side of the water in chapter 15, where we have these songs, I will sing unto the Lord, for the Lord has triumphed gloriously. The horse and rider God has cast into the sea. Remember, did you sing that folk song?
We tried that last week.
And we never came together, did it? Can you sing it?
I don't know.
Unto the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously, horse and rider driven into the sea. I will sing unto the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously, horse and rider driven into the sea. Lord, my God, my strength is from the strong.
Now you are my victory.
Yeah.
The Lord, our God, my strength, my sister. Now he is my victory. And then Aaron's sister, Miriam, picks up trampolines. You know, these were given by the neighbors, along with the bracelets. They said, take all our trampolines. Okay, what is it? Tambourines. And then Miriam and the women of Israel have this fantastic dance on the other, and just picture the scene on this hill overlooking the water, and there are all the horses and chariots are stuck in the mud. Maybe they can even see Pharaoh on the other side, Ramses II, just shaking his fist at this whole thing. And then they dance to this and sing this song. Sing of Yahweh, he has covered himself with glory. Horse and rider, he is thrown into the sea. We begin now with what I think is a radical understanding of God. Because almost every static society has a God who is up here with the big people, with all the important people. And then God helps them rule all the people down here, and it's a neat system. And here you have this God that is with the poor, the slaves, the oppressed, the underdog, the bottom. God is right there. And that's where God enters the scene, and that's where God saves. Now, do you already see the profound meaning of the story of the manger in Bethlehem? God is just being where God always is. With the lowly, bringing salvation. Now, could we look up these two, how the foundation or the primal story works? This is the story that sets this people's identity. You know, if somebody would come up and ask, who are you? Well, it's just interesting, how would we respond? Who are you? And I think we're a little we wouldn't have kind of a common answer to that, would we? That'd be a fun thing to say, the first thing that pops into your mind, who are you? Yeah, well, it would be, they would not have made that distinction. We probably make that distinction much more than they would have. Yeah, we tend to individualize them.
You haven't had a common identity until...
Yeah. We are the winter program. But the way to understand primal story is this, that all through history now, these people, when they understand their identity, would simply say, we are the people that God rescued from Egypt. That would just be who we are. Our whole life is based on that. Everything we do, the way we act, the way we behave, the way we see ourselves, the way we understand, the way we relate, the way we live out our life in this world, it's all, we're the people that God rescued from Egypt. Now, that's what we mean by primal story. And then it's that story that gives your society its meaning and its life. You base your life on that story. Do you know America has a primal myth? Do you know the Horatio Alger story? What is this Horatio Alger story?
Rags to riches.
Yeah, the rags to riches. Story, and you can see, and I found out, I just thought it was a story, but it's an actual man, isn't it? Am I right? That rose from rags to riches, and to be an American is to live this story. This becomes many would say to be an American is to live this story. The American identity is to be a people of this story. That becomes a primal myth, or a primal narrative, or a primal story. Now, I'll move on from there. We want to get to the manna story, but I want to give an image that Paul Hansen gave when he teaches Old Testament at Harvard, right? And when he spoke here at Holden, when he talked about the Egypt and Exodus story, he said, the call is come to the birthing room. Come to God's birthing room. Come to the maternity ward. Now, why would he say that? Do you have a guess?
Back to your identity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
identity orientation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he meant that before this story, you had a motley group of people like this, of memory, a whole bunch of other slaves. They had nothing really in common except they wanted to get out of Egypt. But in this story, they are birthed as God's people. And we can't ever forget as we read the rest of the Bible that metaphor, that these are God's birth people. And now the next picture we're going to move into, and I want to read the story and then we're going to talk about it, is a word that just like Egypt has meaning in the Bible, here's another word, is the word wilderness. This is meaningful to us because we live just a half a mile from a wilderness area, but it's very different than wilderness in Bible times. Have you ever been on the California or Arizona desert? Then if you've been out alone in the quietness of that desert, you're getting more in touch with what we mean by wilderness in the Bible. Now, they could have gone along the ordinary highway to their destination, but instead they go into the desert area of the Sinai Peninsula. And wilderness is much more than a place in scriptures, but I'm going to put it this way. God uses the wilderness as school. You could almost say wilderness equals school. And the school is a place where the lesson is taught. Now, how does a birthed people live out its identity as the people saved from Egypt? Now, how does that people live? And that is the lesson that is taught in the wilderness. What would be some definitions of desert? What are the characteristics of a desert?
Barren.
Barren. Arid. Is it space? Quiet. Is it risky? Mm-hmm. Are you vulnerable?
Mm-hmm.
Is it precarious?
Mm-hmm.
This is the schoolroom. You know, God is not leading these people into a city to teach them how their life will be, but into wilderness. Now, where did Jesus go for 40 days? The wilderness and the desert. What did he learn? You have it in the story of the temptation of Jesus. Wasn't he tempted there on how to run his messiahship? You know, how he was going to do it. And it was a wilderness where the lesson was taught. This is a more obscure part of the New Testament, but when Paul was in deep trouble in the book of Galatians because they accused him of teaching false doctrine, did he say he had learned his doctrine from Peter or from the apostles in the city? Or where did he learn it? Is anybody? This is really a Bible trivia question.
He wasn't in the desert. John the Baptist.
Yeah. Well, Paul says, I went to the Arabian desert all by myself. Where did John the Baptist call the people to come and reform their whole life? To Jerusalem, to the city? That's to the wilderness. So if you get that in mind now, we're going to the wilderness school. And now we're going to look at what I think is a key passage as to the lesson of the wilderness, and it's Exodus 16, the story of the manna. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to read part of the story, and then we're just going to list what the story teaches, or just so we have it in our mind, and then I have a little exercise to do that, then we'll pick up on that next time. But if you want to follow, or else I'm just going to skip around because I'm not going to take time to read the whole chapter. But now the people are in the desert, and this is starting with verse 2. The whole community of the children of Israel began to complain against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness and said to them, "Why did we not die at Yahweh's hand in the land of Egypt, where we were at least able to sit down to pans of meat and could eat bread to our heart's content?" You know, the good old days of slavery, weren't they wonderful? Well, we ate. We had enough to eat. You know, you've brought us out to this desert. You've brought us to this wilderness to starve this whole company to death. Oh, the good old slave days. Then Yahweh said to Moses, "Now I will rain down bread for you from the heavens. Each day the people are to go out and gather the day's portion. I propose to test them in this way to see whether they will follow my law or not. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they have brought in, this will be twice as much as the daily gathering." And then it goes on to describe more about it, and it also includes quails coming. That's why I wasn't sure whether to call this "We Are Manna People" or "We Are Quail People." Down to 12. Then Yahweh spoke to Moses and said, "I have heard the complaints of the children of Israel. Now say this to them, 'Between the two evenings you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall have bread to your heart's content. Then you will learn that I, Yahweh, am your God.' And so it came about, the quails flew in the evening. Then in the morning there was a coating of dew all around the camp. And when the coating of dew lifted, there on the surface of the desert was a thin, delicate, powdery, as fine as hoarfrost on the ground." A thing, I should say, delicate, powdery, and as fine as hoarfrost. "When they saw this, the children of Israel said to one another, 'What is that?' Not knowing what it was. 'That,' said Moses to them, 'is the bread Yahweh gives you to eat.'" Now, an interesting thing here, the word manna, in the ancient meaning of the word manna is, "What is that?" Is that funny? So if you say, "What is that?" and then answer manna, you're really saying, "What is that?" It's, "What is that?" One of the little humorous things. "And this is Yahweh's command. Everyone must gather enough of it for his needs. One omer a head." Okay, now get in your mind, an omer is 2 quarts. This is your daily food, 2 quarts. "According to the number of the persons in your families, each of you will gather for those who share his tent." So the sons of Israel did this. They gathered it, some more, some less. When they measured in an omer what they had gathered, the man who had gathered more had not too much, and the man who had gathered less had not too little. Each found he had gathered what he needed. That would be the patriarch, probably, that would go to gather it, and then enough needed would be there's enough for that person's family. Moses said to them, "Now no one must keep any of it for tomorrow." But some would not listen to Moses. These are the midnight snackers now. "And kept part of it for the following day, and it bred maggots and smelt foul." and Moses was angry with them. And morning by morning they gathered it, each according to their needs, and when the sun grew hot, it dissolved. Now down to 31, the paragraph there talks more about the Sabbath, how you don't gather any on the Sabbath, but there's enough gathered on Friday to last you over Saturday. And that doesn't rot. The house of Israel named it, what is it? Manna. It was like coriander seed. It was white, and its taste was like that of wafers made with honey. And Moses said, this is Yahweh's command. Filled an omer with it. Fill a 2-quart jar with it, and let it be kept for your descendants, to let them see the food that I fed you with in the wilderness when I brought you out of Egypt. And Moses said to Aaron, take a jar, put in it a full omer of manna, and place it before Yahweh to be kept for your descendants. Accordingly, Aaron put a full omer of manna in the jar, as Yahweh had ordered Moses, and placed the manna before the testimony. That's later than then it was put next to the covenant law in the holy box. It was to be kept there. And the children of Israel ate manna for 40 years. Up to the time they reached the inhabited country. They ate manna up to the time they reached the frontier of the land of Cana. Now an omer is 1/10 of an ephah. That's helpful, isn't it?
Yeah, I thought so.
An ephah is 20 quarts, if that helps. Is that a bushel?
Well, I'm
looking up, so. Oh, a bushel.
But that was a lot of work. Mm-hmm. That's why I asked, how did they gather it?
We don't know, but that's one of the points, is that God did not dump this into their tents. They had to go out and work. But let's just review now what happened here, which we call manna. First of all, who gives the manna? These are such simple questions, of course. This is like a Sunday school question. You all say God, and the teacher says, that's nice, children. Or did you?
How about the sky?
Did you? This is an old one, but the children's sermon where the pastor described an animal with a bushy tail and that hopped and gathered acorns, and then said, what is it? And the boy said, it sounds like a squirrel, but it's probably Jesus. So how it goes or something. Because, you know, pastors and Sunday school teachers always want you to say. So, the manna is, first of all, it's a gift from Yahweh. And how often is it given?
Daily.
Daily. Except
on Sunday. Sabbath.
Okay, I'll raise the question again. Did it fall right in your tent so you could just lie in your bed and eat it?
Mm-hmm.
Gathered. Right away here you have the dignity of work. But do you work and gather every day, except Sabbath? How much do you gather?
Just enough.
Yeah, enough. So who gets more? Who needs more? More is to really the larger. When it says families here, we should think more of clans, you know, extended families. The larger clans, who gets less?
Smaller
clans. Do you collect a lot of extra? No excess. What happens to people that collect too much?
Yeah.
stinks. Okay. Stinks. Okay, now under this is also a whole understanding of life. And I'll just ask it this way, is the purpose of life the manna, or is the manna for life? I mean, again, this is an obvious question, but it's so basic, I need to get what's under the story. Manna is for their life. And the people now that start to collect extra are beginning to move to saying, our life and its pride and its identity is based on how much manna I have. Now, that isn't that specific in the story, but do you see how it's under the story? You're right away already moving towards those people, and notice what is Moses' response to them? Yeah, he's vexed. I like that word, he's vexed at these people who are starting to think they can accumulate and have their self-worth based on the manna, which is a gift really for what life really is all about. Would you go into your little group of three again? This is a little fun exercise. And just take these principles, and you are, I'll just set it up this way. I'm trying to think of a way to put this. You're setting up a society of people. Say, 300 people, you're on an island that has enough food, and you have to set up a society, and your only constitution is this story for your society. How will your society work? Is that a clear?
This is the
Now, this is the constitution. The only thing you have for a constitution is this story. How will your society work? See if you can do some imagining. And then, so let's try that. Oh, it's 12 though. Should we start here next? Yeah, I think we better. Or better yet, let's just think about that till tomorrow.